After 36 hours of grounded flights affecting more than 100,000 travelers in the run-up to Christmas, planes are flying in and out of the UK's Gatwick airport again. The London airport was shut down because someone was flying drones overhead, and drones can pose a danger to aircraft. British troops and police snipers were deployed to take out the mysterious drones. Investigators are still looking for the person or people who were responsible for the massive disruption. French media are reporting that a longtime terrorist thought to be responsible for planning the 2015 Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris has been arrested in Djibouti. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports officials are preparing to extradite the suspect to France.
Peter Sherif, who went by the name Abu Hamza, knew the Kouachi brothers who carried out the attack against the satirical weekly news magazine, killing 12 people. The Kouachi brothers were shot dead by French police days after the murderous attack in January 2015. Peter Sherif belonged to the same radical cell in Paris as the two brothers. Sherif was first arrested in Iraq in 2004 for fighting with Al-Qaeda. He escaped from a Baghdad prison in 2007 and headed for Syria. Arrested there, Sherif was extradited to France and jailed for 18 months, but he returned to Yemen to join Al-Qaeda. In 2015, Sherif was placed on a U.S. list of designated global terrorists. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 12 points at 22,872. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru, with their Subaru Share the Love event now through January 2nd. Details on the not-for-profit organizations that it supports are at subaru.com/share. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru.
Support for WPR comes from Garden Visions, a conference for northern climate gardeners of all levels, January 25th and 26th at NTC in Wausau, sponsored by North Central Wisconsin Master Gardeners, gardenvisions.info. Want to know more about a WPR trip or event you heard promoted on air? Our Audience Services Department can help. Contact Audience Services by calling 1-800-747-7444.
Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and my guest today, Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we'll be talking to him about the advantages of starting your plants from seed. We'll talk about what goes into designing a planting bed at the garden and what it takes to attract pollinators. Among other things, he will also take your gardening questions as well. What would you like to know about planting seeds? Or maybe you've got some advice. I'd love to hear that as well. Maybe you have some ideas about plants to recommend for attracting pollinators. I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Mark Conlock is at our Green Bay studios, our WPR Green Bay studios. Mark, thanks for taking time to be with us.
You bet, Larry. Thanks for having me on this winter solstice day.
Yeah,
and night.
The perfect day to have you on. And before we talk about seeds and using seeds, maybe tell us a little bit about the Green Bay Botanical Garden.
Yeah, the Green Bay Botanical Garden, great place to visit. We have our Garden of Lights event going on right now, actually, tonight, December 21st through Sunday from 5 to 9, and then it starts again after the Christmas holiday from the 26th through the 30th from 5 to 9. So that's pretty much a light show of botanical elements. So it's a botanical-themed light show, a little something different. And then we have this Butterflies and Blooms exhibit that we're working on planning right now that'll be next June through August of 2019. So that's kind of exciting. The garden has 23 acres of developed gardens and then 23.5 acres of natural areas. So it's a great place to come for a winter hike, kind of just get out there in nature, have a self-guided tour and see what's happening, get some ideas for your own winter landscape, if you will.
It's a wonderful place, and I love walking through the gardens. I haven't seen the light show, But I would expect you have so many cool structures.
Yeah, yeah, we do.
You can light those up, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, we light those up. We light up our new Grand Garden area. We have a new exhibit, which is actually kind of interesting because it's called VeggieTales. It's a kind of a vegetable garden made out of lights. So you could get some planting ideas of what seeds to grow even from the light show.
Oh, man. Well, I tell you what, we have callers online already with questions, but you like using seeds and getting your plants going from seed.
Yeah, yeah, we probably grow about 20,000 plants from seed, you know, with our staff, and we're able to use the Technical College, Northeast Wisconsin Technical College's greenhouse. So some of the reasons we do it is because, you know, we can grow a wider variety of things that might not be available locally that we can choose from the catalogs, and we have wholesale accounts and things like that. But you could do the same thing, of course, with all the seed catalogs you get that you mentioned and things that you might not be able to buy if you just go to a greenhouse. Also gives you a jump on the season, especially with the vegetables, you know, since we have a pretty short growing season in Wisconsin. You can get ahead of the game with that. And the more you grow from seed, it's usually less expensive, so you can save some money. And then the other kind of cool thing I like is just like the miracle of a seed, you know, seeing that seed sprout. And it's a neat thing to share with kids, children, if you have them, or just for yourself to kind of get, you know, reinvigorated by the beauty and the miracle of nature.
I agree wholeheartedly. Regina in Denmark has something relating, I think, to seeds. Let's go there. Hi, Regina.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a huge garden seed catalog fan, and I love starting my seeds from scratch in my greenhouse or my sunroom. But I'm looking at the soil block makers, which are fairly expensive. But I'm wondering if they are worth the money. Do you know anything about the soil block makers and planting seeds into those directly?
What exactly is the soil block maker?
Well, it actually, instead of putting the dirt in pots, it essentially forms the dirt into a like a block of soil, and it's supposed to help with air pruning the roots, supposed to keep them healthier. And I'm thinking of just planting my vegetable seeds directly into that. That way, I'm not using pots, which is better on the environment, of course.
Well, that's definitely an interesting idea. We pretty much grow all of our plants, you know, in a cell pack, and then we use soilless media because that really helps with, you know, disease problems and things like that, to have start with a sterile medium. So if you use the soil maker, you probably still want to use a soilless media in there, unless you want to, you know, sterilize or pasteurize the soil that you would put in there, because it would potentially have disease organisms in it. The other thing you could do is, you know, some people use like the little newspaper pot maker so that you don't, you know, have the plastic and then, you know, the hydrocarbon use.
So there's a newspaper pot maker?
Yeah, we have like a little, it's pretty much just a little piece of wood, and then you wrap the paper around there. We use it with our children's programming, and then you make a little pot out of newspaper and recycle it that way. Of course, there's also the peat pots and things like that that you could use, and then just make sure, you know, when you replant those in the soil, though, you want that pot to be kind of level with the soil surface or underground so that it doesn't wick moisture away from it. It sounds like the soil block maker, you know, would be in essence kind of a similar type thing. You still, my guess is you still would have to put that soil block in some type of flat or something like that, because as you watered it and started your seeds, it would probably start to eventually crumble a little bit.
Yeah, I would think. Regina, is that the case? Is that what they say?
Yeah, you put them into your standard flat, and that way you've got a place where you can, you know, put the water, and the water wicks up to from the bottom then. But and it looks like you space them about, you know, quarter an inch apart, so the plants don't grow together. But I've been looking at them, but they're kind of expensive, and I'm a bit of a garden tool junkie, and I'm trying to break myself from buying all of the cool stuff and then not using them.
I'm going to have Tyler, our engineer today, look up soil. Well, they're called soil blocks, huh?
Yeah, they're the little, like, they're presses. They're made of steel, and you press it into a pile of soil, and out comes these nice little square-shaped blocks. They're adorable. They're totally cute.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing you could do, of course, is without your, feeding into your passion for the tools, there is just fill a flat with the soilless media, and then plant your seeds in there, and then just kind of take them apart out of there, just in the soilless media or soil if you pasteurized it, and they wouldn't be in little blocks, but you could in essence just take them out, like pricking them apart, kind of.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm starting my tomato seeds, I find that they stand up nicely next to each other when I do that.
Oh. Well, I'm looking at a picture of the soil block makers. Tyler found one for me, and they look pretty cool.
Don't they? Seriously. It's the garden tool, want.
Well, maybe you found a good Christmas present idea for anyone out there that's still on the fence and needs to do some shopping for a gardener.
I know. Wouldn't that be nice? I have to buy all my own tools, though, unfortunately. Everybody else will feed the habit. So.
Thanks, Regina. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Talking today with our guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Great to have him along. And you know what? We'll take another call. Mike in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi there, guys. How are you doing this morning?
Good. Appreciate Great. The call.
Yeah. Got a quick question. This past summer, I played around with heirloom tomatoes for the first time. And I had a lot of success with them, especially with a breed called a Marmon tomato. It almost looked like a pumpkin, but that plant was extremely prolific, and everything was really good on there. The cool thing was the fact they made enough where I could actually share with people who seemed curious. But the thing of it is the fact I had about 6 or 8 breeds, and some of them were supposed to come out deep purple, almost black. And I never wound up getting any of that to a great level of success. I'm wondering if cross-pollination might be an issue. The reason I say that is my mom was unsure if these plants would take off or not, so she decided to have a backup plant. She planted a great big old beefsteak tomato by these darker tomatoes, and everything turned out red.
Oh.
Maybe she planted more beefsteaks than you thought. from what I know, I don't think cross-pollination would be a problem with, the fruit set on your plant that you planted that was, from that other tomato. If it could have been cross-pollinated, and then if you collected seed from that tomato, it could have, your next generation could be a thing. But sometimes, different plants, like a tomato, might pollinate itself in the flower before it actually opens. But that cross-pollination could have affected the next generation. I don't think it would have affected yours. It could have been the other thing I just thought of, it could be just the amount of growing time
that we have
in Wisconsin, that it didn't have time to color up, the way that it should have, or, it does in a warmer climate.
Yeah, that was the thing that ran through my mind, too. Well, Mike, it's a mystery. But we've got a couple of ideas about what might have happened. How did they taste?
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a nice day.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You didn't hear me on that last question. Well, we can take another call here from Robin in Johnson Creek. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
You were talking about different pots for plants, and I wanted to point out they're called cow pots.
Cow pots.
Yeah, they're made out of cow manure processed, so it doesn't smell that much or anything like that. And you can plant the whole thing into the ground, and it degrades and provides a little bit of nutrition for the plant. They're really nice for plants that don't like their roots disturbed, like squash and things like that. So I've used them a lot lately. I really like them. They will start to break down. If you start plants too early, they'll start to break down before you get them into the ground. But they still hold together enough to get there. And they're really handy. And there's no waste.
Cow pots.
I've heard of the cow pie candy, but this is a whole new level.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
interesting. Where did you get these, Robin?
The first time I bought them, I buy a lot of things from Fedco Seeds, so I would buy from there. And I've seen them around since then. I've seen them in Klein's Nursery in Madison.
I'm looking. I went online just to look up cow pots, and it's a pretty cool idea. There'd be some good fertilizer in there, Mark.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting idea, and it's kind of along the soil block. It's just already made for you out of a slightly different material. So, you know, with our caller so far, it's interesting. There's a lot of ways to start a seed successfully.
Yeah, absolutely. How expensive are they, Robin?
They're a little bit pricier, but, I don't know the exact price. It seems to vary depending on where I go. But I've had some plants where I've had some in the pot and some not. They definitely do better in the pot because they get that extra nutrition.
I learn something every week on Garden Talk, cow pots, something that I don't think we ever talked about before. Thank you, Robin.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Yeah.
Mark Conlock, our guest, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. We started out talking about seeds and getting your plants started from seeds, and we'll certainly continue on that. And we'll take other garden questions or comments or maybe experiences. We've had some great experiences here. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and my guest, of course, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have him along, and thanks so much for listening in. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I've learned about cow pots, and I've learned about soil block makers already on the show. Maybe you have too. Maybe you've got an experience to share. So give a call or shoot us an email and join on in. Vivian in Green Bay, your turn.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two things. Love your show. I had heard that people could start seeds in avocado shells. And then transplant them, and they biodegrade, and you've got nothing left but, your seedling. But I know you're going to talk about pollinator plants, and I have an experience to share with the Silphium, the compass plant, is a better choice than the cup plant, which is the choice I made, and I love it because there are bees all over that plant, and it's way up 10, taller than my garage. The bees are way in the air, and it does a great job. But the compass plant tends to take over. The compass plant, I guess, is smaller and doesn't spread as rapidly. But the cup plant has worked as a water garden plant. In the spring, when the shoots, the stalks are all dead, I can go out there and kick them with my foot at ground level, and they make the most awesome kindling because they're all dry fiber.
Oh.
They're lightweight. I mean, it's just a multi-purpose plant. I really love that cup plant. it tends to want to move around, and it can be very difficult to dig out because it has very, very deep roots. So that's all.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. What's your experience, Mark, with cup plants?
They're both good plants, both native to Wisconsin, prairie plants. I actually, on the UWGB campus here, I drove past the, the Keith White Prairie and other prairies here that Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery helped take care of and install and study when he was here. So it made me think of him when she mentioned that. So both of them are neat plants. The compass plant, has that kind of like dissected leaf to it. And then that tall flower stalk, that pollinators and other insects will go on. Same with the cup plant. Like she said, it's kind of a neat plant because it has like a square stem, and then the leaves are perfoliate where they go along the stem, and then it makes the little like drinking cup, or it holds water there, so it's also a water source. So kind of an interesting thing, a plant that would be a food nectar source, seeds, but then also in essence a little bird bath drinking fountain in your yard. And like she said, that guy can seed around a bit and become a bit aggressive. So that's just something to think about, you know, when you plant it, or if you plant it in an area that you don't mind if that happens, that can be okay. And both of them get to be, especially the cup plant, it gets to be a very tall plant, the whole plant. The compass plant has kind of the leaves that are basal, and then it shoots up the flower stalk. So those are kind of just two things to know about when you're designing with them, you know, that the one has the basal foliage with the tall flower stalk, that's the compass plant. And the other one gets to be pretty tall and, you know, in general, a big plant. So you want that maybe at the back of your border, and then you want to consider that it might, you know, become a bit aggressive and spread around. You might have cups for more people than you want at your table.
Do you have them at the garden?
Yeah, well, we don't have a compass plant that I know of, but we do have cup plants, and we planted them actually kind of in that type of an area by a big stormwater detention pond that we have. So it kind of works nice as a backdrop. It hides that detention pond, and then it provides habitat right, you know, near there.
Let's take another call. Dan in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, great show. Two hopefully quick questions. I heard heirloom tomatoes come up, and I've started growing them over the past few years, but they're not as prolific as I would like them to be because I just love eating them, but there's not many I'm getting. And the second question is my garden. I was wondering if you had any recommendations on how many times you till it a year. I mean, I use straw as a weed preventative, and we have 25 chickens, and I throw their manure out there too. So should I turn it up in the fall and in the spring? And thank you very much. Great show.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Interesting questions. Yeah, I think the heirloom thing is probably pretty spot on, you know, where they're more for the taste. And then a lot of times, as you know, probably, or everyone does, like they can be more susceptible to diseases and things. So something that made me think about that question was actually some of the conferences I went to. There's some breeding being done. I think it's at North Carolina State University, where they're looking at, you know, bringing some disease resistance into the heirlooms. So getting the taste of the heirlooms and then the disease resistance from, you know, kind of the further breeding efforts, and then maybe they'll be more prolific. So I can't remember off the top of my head those cultivars, but if you look at North Carolina State breeding, you'll probably see some of the cultivars that might have the best of both worlds, or they're working on that type of a thing, you know, to have productive ones with good taste but also disease resistance.
And does fertilization may play a role if you over-fertilize, especially with nitrogen? Are you going to maybe cut back on the amount of fruit?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Larry. That could be the case.
He sounded like a pretty aggressive gardener. I was thinking, I wonder how much fertilizer he's using, or even organic. He said he was using the chicken manure, which is a high nitrogen.
Yeah, so that could be a really good point. Maybe don't use as much of that fertilizer, because like you said, it'll be more the leafy green growth and then not as much fruit production. So that could be another issue with that. And then the other question about the tilling, that's kind of a fascinating question, because at the botanical garden, we've, you know, stopped tilling as much as we have probably over like the last 7 to 8 years. We really don't till our annual display beds anymore. We switched over to an organic fertilizer regime where we use the Sustain, which is a composted turkey litter product, and then Purple Cow organic compost. And then we pull our bulbs out in the spring and we add those fertilizers on top as we're doing that, and it kind of just like garden forks it into the ground. And some of the reasons we stop the tilling is, you know, because it kind of tears up the soil structure all the time. And then it also, from what we've heard from different professors and things, it might kind of like, it prefers bacterial breakdown versus fungi breakdown of nutrients and things like that. So it kind of like is the soil health. It's kind of a simple way to say it, I guess. So he might want to consider, you know, just putting those materials on the ground and forking them in a little bit, and then he might get an overall better soil composition if you don't till it up so frequently.
You mentioned Purple Cow, and Bonita from Muscadet emailed to say she was talking about cow pots. She thinks they're great, and you can purchase them at Jung's stores for sure. Then you fill them with Purple Cow soil, she says. When she sets the plants in the garden, she just breaks the bottom of the cow pot out and set the pot and all the and all of it in the transplant hole. So there you go.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Harold in Burnham Wood next. Hi, Harold.
Good morning. I heard the word prairie mentioned and immediately my ears lit up. I've got some prairie that's varies anywhere from about 10 years to almost 20 years of age. And after you get a prairie going, you realize, I wish I had spent more money on the Forbs. And it's very difficult to get those started. I do burn regularly. One-fourth, roughly a fourth, gets burned every year. There's become about almost 30 acres. Okay. I've tried originally by just saving seeds and scattering them, but then you find out that there's so much leftover product from the years before, it never gets to the ground. So I've started by, after the burn, trying to lightly work up the soil with a very light drag and put seeds in that way, additional seeds of the Forbs. Any other suggestions of what I might help to establish more flowers?
That seems like a good idea. If you got going so far, Harold, what do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I guess the thing I've learned is that when I've gone to the presentations by Neil DeBull and others, you know, when we think of a prairie, we like to think of the flowers, but it really was more of a grass ecosystem. So, you know, what you have is actually probably more of what the prairie would be, more grasses than forbs and flowers. But, of course, we like the pretty flowers. So the only other thing I could think that you, I mean, you might want to consult with Prairie Nursery or some other, you know, Prairie Moon or someplace like that that might have other ideas that they've done on their different restoration projects or helping homeowners. The other thought I thought of was, you know, you might want to consider buying, say, a larger plant that's in a, say, a gallon container or something like that, and then, you know, digging a hole for that plant, you know, and maybe, you know, clearing away it a little bit so it has a fighting chance against all your well-established grasses and forbs that you have, because that's kind of what you found out, that the issue is that everything else is very successful. It sounds like you're doing a great job, and what you plant in there can't outcompete what you have, so the thing to think about, I say, would be to like get a big enough plant that can compete with what you have and then give it a fighting chance by kind of clearing the things around where you plant that plant.
Just thinking about Neil, the last time Neil DeBall was on the show, he was talking about the timing of when you plant a prairie, either spring or fall, has an effect on what is going to be more prevalent. And I'm not going to go into that explanation, but I would encourage Harold to take a look at the Prairie Nursery website, and he talks about it at that website, too. So There you go. Thank you so much, Harold. Good luck. Jim in Milwaukee, it's up to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Good morning. I had a question about that Mexican walking corn that nitrogenates itself, where you cut down a that fertilizer while growing it, and I was wondering if it would grow in the Wisconsin Midwest area.
Well, I don't really, unfortunately, know about that corn, but it sounds like, you know, we obviously grow corn, so I would imagine that it's possible to grow it here.
I would think so. And, you know, it's one of those things, Jim, you know, you're a gardener, you're an experimenter. I would certainly give it a try, at least on a limited basis, just to see what happens.
Yeah,
you know, why not? I'd give it a shot.
All right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Today, as we visit with Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at Green Bay Botanical Garden. Always great to have him come by. And we started by talking about using seed and getting your plant started from seed. We've taken a whole variety of questions, got into the whole area of, soil block makers and cow pots and how they can benefit plants. One caller earlier, and I forgot to bring up another point that she brought up relating to pots. She said that she had read where the husk from an avocado, you can use those as planters, essentially. Put your seed in there and then just put it in the ground when you've got it going, and you know, it decomposes over time. Seems to make sense to me, Mark, although you got to be eating a lot of avocados if you need a lot of seeds.
Yeah, that's a true thing. I guess you can probably grow a seed in almost anything. That might be an expensive planter, though, with the cost of avocados, too. I mean, sometimes they sell them at guacamole at market prices in a restaurant now. But I was just going to say one other thing, Larry. It's like, you know, in terms of, like, the amount of plants, like, when we grow them at a large scale, say, at, you know, the botanical garden or greenhouse, the big thing that we always think about is having a sterile environment, you know, because you're kind of you're producing the exact right systems for not only plants to grow, seeds to germinate, but also diseases to grow. So my concern about a thing like that might be, yeah, if you're growing a little thing, you know, it's not a big deal if you're growing a couple of them, but if you were, like, ever going to grow like a bunch of things, you might have to see, make sure that avocado skin is cleaned off so that there's no diseases brought in on it to, like, you know, your plant might start growing and then you could get damping off or other diseases like that.
No, I didn't think about that. While she was talking about that, I was thinking about limey, my lime tree, which it's unfortunately, limey produces a whole lot of limes, but not where I could save the husks because she's full of limes right now. But, you know, come time to, well, when would we start with seeds?
Well, the good question, it all depends on what seed you're growing. You know, a lot of them on the seed packet is a good starting point. For the things we grow, sometimes we grow perennials from seeds, say like an echinacea coneflower.
Yep.
And that we usually start in the middle of January because we can actually get them to flower the first year from seed. The other thing that's one of our first ones we grow are begonias. Some of those we grow from seed and they start like the first week of February. And their seeds are really small, like powder. So it's kind of crazy because when they first germinate, it's just like a little green dot on the soil surface. But then it becomes, you know, it could become a huge like whopper or dragon wing begonia over the, you know, months that it's growing. A lot of the things we start in, you know, kind of the end toward the beginning of March, actually.
Mark Conlock, our guest, as we talk gardening with him. We've zeroed in a bit on seeds, but taking other questions, of course, as well. Let's go to John in Burlington next. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious if there was any studies done on which plants remove the most CO2 from the atmosphere.
Huh.
Well, good question. I'm not sure, but I know I just actually read a thing this morning talking about, it was actually like about a tree farm where they were coppicing the conifers and having them regrow. And it said how the young growth, you know, would take up more carbon dioxide. And they were investigating that for fast growing plants like cottonwoods and popples and things like that, you know, to kind of sequester the carbon and then, you know, take it out of the atmosphere and then somehow use it for a fuel source that hopefully wouldn't put it back into the atmosphere. So I think they have been doing some research on it. It would be really interesting to, you know, investigate that more and see, you know, if that is a method that they can use to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere more. I also read another interesting article that was saying how at night, actually, you know, plants do take some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So they were looking at redoing the, you know, say global climate change models because that hadn't been accounted for in the past.
Very interesting. Well, we'll do a little searching around on that and see what we can come up with, John. It'd be interesting to know for sure. And that was that research you were talking about or that work you were talking about, Mark, is really interesting. Don in Woodville, we'll go to you next. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm here.
Yeah, what's on your mind today?
Well, we've got a pretty good-sized garden, and I always grown cucumbers. My wife puts up a lot of pickles. This last summer was very unusual. The cukes took off like crazy, and every 2 weeks I add a couple seeds here and there. Well, they got up to blossoming, hundreds of blossoms, and about 90% of the blossoms wilted. We usually get 30, 40 quarts of pickles, and we got like 7 or 8 quarts out of our garden this year.
Oh. So you went from having about a quart of pickles almost every week to one every 10 weeks.
I went out and bought some cucumbers.
There you go, Don.
Farmer's market.
Man, any ideas on that, Mark?
Well, just a couple ideas that came to my mind. And the most important one maybe being that, from what I know, cucumbers, you know, are pollinated by, you know, pollinators, bees and things like that. So maybe there weren't enough of them around to cross-pollinate, you know, to get fruit set. So yeah. One thing you could potentially do in the future is, well, I mean, of course, you could plant pollinator plants around your garden that might attract them. But you could also use a Q-tip or something like that to, you know, cross-pollinate them yourself to see if you could increase, you know, the amount of fruit set.
Yeah, that's worth a thought for, worth a try as well. Don, thank you. Appreciate the call. Ray in Stevens Point, your turn now.
A couple months ago, you had a professor from UW-Madison Ag Department on talking about the Mexican Chihuahua corn. It cannot be grown in Wisconsin because it takes about 9 to 10 months to go from seed to when the corn is ready to be picked. So with our weather conditions here in the Midwest, it would not work. What the department is hoping to do is to try to genetically link the genes that create the nitrate-absorbing nodes with a different variety of corn that might be able to grow in the Midwest.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much. And that was something that was on my own show. Oh, man. Well, you know, my memory isn't as good as it used to be. But I appreciate that, and I'm pretty sure I know that's right. And I think the only way you'd be able to do it to start, with the current seeds and the current variety that we have would be to do it all in a greenhouse.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. Hey, and you could start it really, 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 really early and then plant it out, but that would be a lot more work than it'd probably be worth.
Yeah, might be fun to kind of experiment with it, but it'd be a fair amount of work. Let's wait and see what the horticulturists here at the University of Wisconsin can come up with. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions, or email us. We've had some great emails as well at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at Green Bay Botanical Garden, on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have him along. Thanks so much for listening in. Question or comment or maybe an experience to share in the gardening area, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And before I forget about it, I do want to mention that as part of a long-standing tradition, Santa Claus will be coming to this program on Christmas Eve, which, of course, is Monday. So if you have a youngster at your home, you're one of your own kids, or maybe you're a grandparent and you've got the grandkids there on Christmas Eve, I hope you'll have them call the show, because only young children can call the show when Santa Claus is on. And tell you what, it's a highlight program, one of the highlight programs of the year when Santa Claus comes by. Usually sometimes with Mrs. Claus, sometimes he brings along one of his elves. So that's 11 o'clock to 12:30 on Monday on Christmas Eve. Well, let's get back to the garden here and talk to Chris in Shamrock. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks a million for the show. I always learn so much listening to you.
Thank you.
I have a very simple question. We live in the country and have a standard or a conventional septic system, which has a drain field. We're thankful we have really, really good soil. But like this last year when it was kind of dry, I was mowing, you know, still every 5 or 6 days because of the fact that I have good fertile soil, and it was watered a lot. Is it feasible to, in a spot where grass grows really, really good, get rid of that and turn that into a prairie area?
I would say yes. In fact, I know we're giving a lot of shout-outs to Prairie Nursery, but I believe they have kind of a septic system mix, if you will, you know, that's recommended for that type of an application. The other thing I thought of was, you know, depending on the exact site of it, you could look at some type of no-mole grass mix, you know, so that'll be a fescue blend. It would kind of flop over a little bit more, and some people aren't as interested in the aesthetics as, you know, they think it's going to look at first, but, you know, that could be another great option, because then you would have, you know, some type of vegetation over there, either the prairie septic mix or the no-mole grass mix, and you wouldn't have to do all that extra mowing.
Yeah, it works very well, and I was kind of second just because I'm sure there are other prairie mixes out there for drain fields, but I know a Prairie Nursery has a really a nice one, but there are others out there too. Sure worth it, Chris. They actually help the drain field. So those deep-rooted plants, very, very good that you called. Thank you so much. I want to go back and again join in 800-642-1234 with your questions or comments or maybe your experiences to share as we talk about all things in the garden. Do you get a lot of garden catalogs, seed catalogs, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sometimes we get three of the same catalog, man. But it is neat to see all those pictures, you know, especially, you know, this time of the year in winter, all those colors really get you excited about the upcoming gardening season. And sometimes the garden of your dreams is better than it turns out to be in the summer, right?
Well, you know, let's talk just a little bit about some of the basics. There are probably a lot of people that have never started their seeds, their plants from seeds. What are the kind of the top tips that you have for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, obviously you want to pick, you know, your garden out and decide what you want to grow. And after you have that, you'll want to think about how many of these plants do you want to grow. Then you'll have to get the material. So whether you go with the solid block or the cow pot, or, you know, go to your local, you know, Home Depot or Stein's or whatever garden center, you can usually buy, you know, the way that we typically do it is we'll have the flat, the insert, you know, which could have 48 or 36 or whatever amount of holes for the amount of plants you need. And then we recommend the soilless media mix because, as I mentioned previously, it's sterile. So all those things you buy initially would be sterile, so you wouldn't have that disease organism in there to start off with that you'd have to contend with so that you are successful in your seed growing. The kind of the interesting thing is what you want to do when you get that soilless media is actually wet it down a little bit so that it's not like hydrophobic and the water doesn't just run off it. So we usually get a big like storage tub and we dump it into there and kind of slightly wet the soilless media, fill the containers that we're growing in. And then the seeds, you know, in general, you put them 2 to 3 times deep as the seed is wide, typically. Some of them that are so small, like powder, you just sprinkle on the soil surface. Some of them that are larger, you know, like, I don't know, an osteospermum or something that has a really big seed, we put that, you know, 2 to 3 times deep, cover it with the soilless media. We usually sprinkle a little vermiculite on the top of our soil just to help, you know, hold the moisture right where that seed needs it. And then if you're a homeowner, you know, where you're kind of growing, you might want to consider those plastic-topped flats because that'll help hold the moisture in right away. Then what we'll do is we'll sprinkle the top with water. If you are doing it at your house, you probably want to invest in a little spray bottle and then just spray the surface because the seed needs water. It has to imbibe moisture so it hydrates all the organelles and then starts to grow. The first thing that'll happen is that first root, the radical, will come down. So that's the first step of germination. So you kind of want to just keep the surface wet at first. And then as that happens, the radical goes down and the first cotyledon seed leaves grow. Then you can start to water a little deeper because you want that root to grow down, just like the prairie plants kind of mine the soil for moisture. You want your seedling to do that. And then you can start to, you know, once your cotyledon leaves open up, you probably want to take that top off because you want, you don't want so much moisture, you know, all around the plant itself because that's where it can lead to the disease. And then you start to water more frequently, You also need to put that thing in light. That's the other thing the seeds need to germinate, right? So, like, you, when I was growing them in my apartment in River Falls where I went to school, I had a card table, and I kind of moved that around throughout my apartment to get light for everything throughout the day for it to grow. So you want the light. Or you could, of course, set up some kind of, you know, a light system, you know, with a grow light, you know, that you would put over the top of it.
Somebody called. I can remember somebody saying that they moved theirs around. They had a cart on wheels, so it was easier.
Yeah, it sounds like they're smarter than I am. That would have been a great idea.
Heck of a lot easier to move that stuff around when you've got some wheels to put on the cart for sure. And then I think light. You know, you mentioned light. Light, it needs to be reasonably close to begin with, for sure, and actually probably throughout.
Yep, that's a good point. You want to have the light really close to the soil surface, and then as your plants, you know, grow, you would just kind of like lift it up. So sometimes they have like a little chain pulley system that you can use if you're using supplemental lighting. Or, you know, like the thing I would do is I would turn my flat so like the plants will obviously go toward the sun, so then I would flip them, you know, 180 degrees to kind of get the plant to work its way back. But if you don't have enough light, you'll get that you know, longer internode growth and have lanky, floppy plants. So that's a big thing to consider, is to have enough light. That's important.
I was thinking about Limey again, because Limey's taken a definite turn for the
poor Limey.
Bending over. No, it's bending. She's pretty good. She's in great shape, but looks healthy as can be, but she's leaning to the light, even though I have some grow lights. And it's a mistake I made early on, not turning her around, and so she got started that way, and it's pretty tough getting her back the other direction.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So you just have to keep turning her, dancing, keep dancing with Limey.
Well, I'm not moving her now because she's got so many limes on her. I don't want to knock them off. But anyway, let's talk some more about the Green Bay Botanical Garden, because you mentioned the light show. And Jill was telling me about the amount of effort that goes into a light display. And, you know, Green Bay Botanical Garden's got one. There was one at Olbrich. We may be visiting some family members. We may be going to the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, because they have a light show on right now. And I imagine the amount of work that they put in is probably similar to you. But just talk about the amount of work that goes in. And it's not something you do like the month before.
No, good point. Yeah, Dave Barco, our facilities supervisor, is the wizard of lights, and he's in charge of setting it up with Sarah Pingle, who's one of our horticulturalists. And then, of course, all of our volunteers, and we've had a couple staff members that we're starting to train, Seth and Ryan, on the whole setup of it. So they start, Larry, you know, pretty much in the beginning of October, actually, setting that up. So part of our staff will switch over to the whole setup of the light show with a huge amount of our volunteer crews. And the technical college helps us set up some of the taller things with their different, you know, equipment that they have. And then the rest of us will be doing the garden cleanup and the bulb planting and all that thing. So, yeah, it takes them 6 weeks to set it up. And then, as Dave will tell you, you know, he's really working on it throughout the whole year, actually, because they made that whole new VeggieTales display. And some of our volunteers actually created those light frames. They welded them at their garage shops that they had. And Dave, you know, bought all the lights to add to them. So volunteers were, you know, putting the lights on the new displays throughout the summer months. So it's really almost a year-long effort. So it's pretty amazing how much, you know, time and energy and effort goes into those light shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kathleen in Delavan has something for us. Let's go to Kathleen. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, since you're doing seed starting, I'm very excited that Prairie Moon has this little seed again, and it's the oval-leaved milkweed. It's native here, and it's a beautiful dwarf. It only gets like 2 feet tall, so everybody in the city and the suburbs could grow it, and it won't take over their yard. And they just have to put it in the refrigerator, you know, when they get it. And they were out for a while, so they're kind of hard to get and kind of rare. And it's a great milkweed for a smaller space. So I just thought I'd let people know.
Oh, and now again, it's the oval leaf?
Oval leaf milkweed, yep.
Ovaly. And you've grown it, and does it attract butterflies?
Oh, absolutely. It'll be, yep, there'll be monarchs and butterflies everywhere. But it's nice because it won't take over your yard or your gardens because it's only about 2 feet tall. And it's pretty.
And it's pretty. All right.
Does, yeah.
Does it have a flower?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it has a milkweed flower.
Oh,
What color is the flower?
I think it's pink or it's either pink or purple or it may be either.
Pink or purple.
Yeah, but if you look it up, the leaves are pretty. You know, they're not those huge leaves, but they're big enough for a hungry caterpillar. And people should know that the first year they might disappear in, mid-July, but they're putting down roots, so don't give up on it.
All right. Oval leaf milkweed. Kathleen, thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate the call. Rollin in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Rollin.
Hello. About a year ago, I had a peach, and there was a seed in there that I planted, and it actually grew. And through the course of time, well, I have it in my living room now in a 5-gallon bucket. It's about 3 feet tall. And I was wondering if I would be able to plant that outside as a permanent resident, not that I would anticipate any fruit off of it, you know, just for aesthetic purposes, or is that type of tree, let's say it came from Georgia, not able to acclimate to the winter dormancy?
And you're in Green Bay, Rollin.
Yes. Yes, I am.
You on the water?
No, well, not too far away from the water.
Okay, yeah, you're never too far away from the water in Green Bay, are you? Well, what do you think, Mark?
Was it a peach that you started from one that you got from a grocery store, or was it like a tree that you had in your yard or got from someone that was growing it in the Green Bay area?
No, it was a peach that I got from the grocery store, and I think it may have been like a Georgia peach.
Okay.
It started from a seed.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty great that you grew it. My guess would be that it wouldn't, you know, be a hardy one, so that it might not live. I mean, you could try it, of course, but of course then you could also lose it. But there are some peaches like Reliance, and there's other cultivars, you know, that are kind of proven hardy to our area, that some of Master Gardeners in Green Bay, and we have one at the Botanical Garden that actually did die over this last winter, unfortunately, so it wasn't reliable by us. But I know some of volunteers and Master Gardeners have had them, and even have been in the paper with their, you know, baskets full of peaches that they have had. So, you know, if you really are into peaches, you probably could grow one in Green Bay, just you have to get the hardy cultivar. The one that you grew likely would not be hardy in our zone, I would say.
Yeah. Or you could take a branch and add it to one of the hardy ones. Could you do that, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, you could try to graft that on there and then see if that particular, you know, the one that you started from seed was hardy, then it would die back if it wasn't. That might be more work than you're willing to do, but...
It might be kind of fun, though, eh?
Yeah, right? Grow some corn and throw a peach on there.
Oh, my goodness. Rollin, thank you so much for calling. Our guest today is really, really fun, having a fun time with him, Mark Conlock. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Their lights display runs Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays from 5 to 9, if I'm not mistaken. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Have you with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we've been answering your gardening questions, talking about the garden a bit, and zeroed in sometimes on seed, but taking other questions as well. So, you have a question, comment, or maybe you've got a plant to recommend or an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Mark, you know, I Well, the news was on. I took a look at those oval leaf milkweeds, and they are a pretty plant. I don't know if you haven't grown them in the botanical garden, have you?
I don't think so, Larry. It doesn't ring a bell. But I was going to mention one other thing I thought about during that call was that there is the butterfly milkweed, you know, with the orange flower that's a little bit of a shorter plant that could easily be incorporated into people's, you know, smaller garden spaces as well. So that's another good pollinator plant that's a little bit more manageable milkweed that people could consider.
Yeah,
as well as looking into the oval leaf one now, too.
And they just for a pollinator garden, you guys obviously have done a great job at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. But talk a bit about getting one started.
Yeah, I've been investigating it for our butterfly house exhibit, you know, that we're going to do for next year, June through August. And what I've pretty found really fascinating was kind of like, you know, the first step would be to think about the butterflies and what do they actually need? You know, what are, first of all, what would the adults need for a food source, because they're the pretty guys that you want around there. But then you have to think about the whole life cycle. So what would the caterpillar, you know, need to eat? So what I found is that, you know, probably a pollinator garden in terms of the butterflies is a little more exacting or different than you might think, because a lot of the caterpillars actually like, say, willows or different trees or shrubs, you know, and things like that. Whereas you think of the classic pollinator garden, you would think of, you know, some of our prairie plants or lavender hyssop, or one really pollinator plant for bumblebees that we've noticed is this Montrose white calamint, which isn't a native plant to Wisconsin, but it is used by these pollinators, you know, to excess. So it's kind of a cool thing because it's, you know, there's the whole native side of it, which is extremely important, but then it's kind of intriguing that the pollinators sometimes are attracted to, you know, non-native plants almost more than they are to the natives. But with the whole butterfly thing, you know, you have to think about trees and shrubs as well as the perennials and annuals. And a lot of the other kind of crazy thing I learned is that a lot of the adult butterflies use other things and are almost practically kind of recyclers of what they use for food, where they're kind of using, you know, kind of strange things for their food, where, you know, like they might use a carrion or something like that to get food source from, or different, you know, mud puddles and things like that. And that was like their most used food source.
Really, really cool. We have callers online with questions for you, so let's go to Frances in Muskego next. Frances, hi.
Hi. I want to know if I can cover my strawberries yet with straw. Or it seems like on the top surface is a little muddy, but when you try to go down, it's froze. So when do I decide I should cover them?
Good question. I'm not a strawberry expert, even though I did work at a fruit research farm at River Falls in the summer months. But I would say, you know, in general, when you're kind of thinking about covering things, once, you know, the ground freezes is a good time to, you know, mulch or cover things, because then you'll hold that coolness in and you won't, you know, get the freezing and the thawing and the heaving potentially. So probably, you know, even though it has warmed up a little bit, now wouldn't be a bad time to do it, I would guess.
Yeah, unless if you've got mud on top, I don't know that I'd be of the soil. I'm not sure that I'd be putting it down right at the moment.
Just wait till it really freezes on top of the ground, and because when you go, you can get a mud layer on top, but then you try to go down, it's frost. So, okay, maybe I better wait then a little longer. I lost them all last year. I don't want to lose them this year.
Okay.
Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I get a little worried about that mud. If you put the mulch on it now, Mark, wouldn't you'd be taking a risk, wouldn't you?
Yeah, probably a little bit, but you know, if it's frozen just below that soil surface and just a little bit of the top, you know, melted,
muddy.
I wouldn't worry too much about it. But you know, that brought up an interesting thing I just thought of is, speaking of seed starting, there is a strawberry called Deliz, or Delish, or however you pronounce it exactly, that's an All-America selection winner, and you can actually grow it from seed. And you'd start it, you know, pretty early, probably January or February. But it will flower all season long and produce strawberries for you that first year. So even if you do lose all your strawberries, look into growing that one from seed from All-America Selections, Deliz, And that would be something that you could use to bypass, and no matter when you do your mulching, you would still get fruit by growing that guy from seed.
That is really interesting. How, do you know how to spell that? Deliz? Is it D-E-L-I-Z?
Yep, but one extra Z on there. D-E-L-I-Z-Z is how you spell it, I believe.
That's really cool. I hadn't heard about that one. So there you go, Francis. Thank you. Helen in Madison.
I think it's a foolish question of the day. I've had a lawn service for the first time ever, and I've had a long-standing vegetable garden, and I wonder if the two are compatible. And sometimes I've seen them apply when I thought one day I should have stopped them because it seemed more windy than normal.
Yeah.
Take my answer off the air.
All right.
Well, I mean, I guess I would just kind of think about what you need the lawn service for and what they're applying and make sure that, you know, what they're applying is what you want them to and it doesn't impact your vegetables if you're concerned about that. I mean, if they're applying things to just the lawn and it's not drifting or going onto your vegetables, you would hope that you'd be okay. But, you know, you could consider what they're treating for. I mean, if they're getting rid of the different weeds and things that, you know, pollinators and other plants might use that might affect potentially your vegetable production and things like that. So just kind of think about what your goals are of your lawn care program versus your vegetable growing and make sure that they're aligned is what I would say for advice.
Yeah, I'd be a little bit, you know, if they were out there on a windy day, for sure, you want to know which way the wind is blowing, that's for sure.
Right, and maybe if you speak with them and just, you know, make sure they know what your goals are for that vegetable garden, if there's any, you know, question about the drift, they just, you know, change their schedule to come back a different day.
Yeah, no reason why they couldn't do that. Thanks very much for that call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. You mentioned Deliz as a new strawberry that you can grow from seed, which I love that idea. Are you going to try that?
Yeah, we have grown it for quite a while, actually.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, we're an All-America Selection display garden and trial garden for ornamentals from seed. So, you know, another quick thing is that if you are looking into growing plants from seed, All-America Selections is a good place to kind of take a look since those have been proven throughout their trial gardens, you know, throughout the country. And Berner Botanical Garden and, Berner Botanical Garden is a display garden too. So if you're looking for ideas, you know, in southeast Wisconsin, that's a great place to check it out. And Green Bay Botanical Garden is a trial garden and a display garden. So that Deliz strawberry is one of those winners. And then there is a lot of different vegetables and other ornamentals that have been proven through there. So that's kind of a cool place to get, you know, ideas for what seeds you might want to start.
Yeah, and do you have any that you're particularly fond of? Not only Deliz, but some of the other flowers or vegetables?
Yeah, there's, one of the things that I like that we were just looking at in our garden designing yesterday with the horticulturist was Jolt Dianthus. I really like, that's an easy one to start from seed, and it flowers all season long. And if you start it early, you can even use it kind of like as a spring, you know, container plant or a spring garden plant. So, you know, a lot of times we use lettuce and pansies and dianthus and the osteospermums that we start, you know, from seed early is our, kind of like our spring color wave. So those are all things that I like to think about. The dianthus is nice because then it blooms, you know, all summer long as well.
And that one's called Jolt?
Yeah, Jolt.
J-O-L-T.
Yes, Jolt and Deliz, what a combination.
Yeah, a Deliz Jolt we're getting here on Garden Talk. Well, let's go to Janet in Hurley next. Hi, Janet.
Hello. About 30 years ago, when we lived in Chicago, a friend planted a peach pit from a Georgia peach. Well, lo and behold, it took root and it grew into a full-size tree. The peaches were delicious.
Oh.
It lived for about 5 or 6 years.
And then and then the winter got it, probably.
Probably the winter got it. I moved from there then, so I really don't know.
Was that right in Chicago?
Yes, it was in Chicago. The soil was a bit on the sandy side, but, you know, the winters in Chicago are horrible.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. You get awfully windy.
Yes. And the year we had, what was it, 6 feet of snow? And I've been trying to get a hold of a Georgia peach, but here in Hurley, all we get is the California peaches. I cannot get a Georgia peach.
Well, I'm not sure where you can get a Georgia peach either, Janet, right now. I haven't looked at peaches in the grocery store, so I'm not sure.
He got the peach at a grocery store, and he told me what he was going to do. And several years later, there's this peach tree blooming like crazy.
You know, Mark, how do you start, be it a peach pit or maybe an avocado pit? What's the best way? Would you use the same technique?
Yeah, I would use the same technique. I know the avocados, you know, you can kind of like take that seed, and what I've done before is, you know, put like toothpicks in them and kind of like hang it over the just cup of water, and then they'll actually root into there. The peaches I've started where I've actually kind of like opened up the pit and taken the seed out of like the outer coating of it, because inside is the part, you know, that actually becomes the peach tree. So that's one way to, but you could still plant the whole thing too and let it decompose to get there. And I'm sure there's plenty of ways to look at it, you know, on the internet too and see, you know, what your methodology would be. So it sounds like he could, you know, like we said, you could try your peach out there. It's just that it's questionable whether it's going to actually be hardy in Wisconsin climate. There's probably a reason they call them Georgia peaches.
Yeah. Sandy in Gays Mills says she's been able to get Georgia peaches from Amish stores. So if you're looking, Jan, if you're looking for a peach, a Georgia peach, maybe if you've got an Amish store in your area, you might be able to get one. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. What seeds work best planted directly into the garden?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, some vegetables work best in the garden, you know, like our radishes, beets, things like that. Corn usually works best in there. And then a lot of like what I consider, say, our, I consider them our cottage plants that we have at Green Bay Botanical, like bread seed poppies or love in a puff and different, you know, kind of ones that you consider as kind of more of a cottage old-fashioned seed, say a cleome or something like that. Those ones seem to typically do better if you direct seed them into the ground. And kind of an interesting thing we do at the Botanical Garden, and you can do it in your own landscape designing, is if you have some of those self-seeding annuals, you can just let them seed out into, you know, your garden over the late summer and fall. And then instead of starting them from seed inside your house, just let them germinate in your garden. And then we call it kind of gardening by editing them out or by weeding them out of, you know, your garden bed. And then you kind of start to learn what the seedlings look like, too. And then, you know what's a weed, obviously, and what's a seedling. But that's another kind of way to do a seeded garden, actually, is with self-seeding annuals.
Alan in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I built a raised strawberry bed for my wife a few years ago, and I made it about 26 inches tall. And the soil has settled. The berries came up great, but the soil is settled, and I wonder if I can add more over the dormant berries now, or if I have to lift those plants out and add the soil.
Well, my inclination would probably be to lift them out and add the soil and then replant them. You kind of have to do that anyway with strawberries after a few years. And I don't think I would cover up that crown, because that's, you know, probably not the right thing to do with the strawberry. That all the growth comes from the crown, so I'd be very leery of covering that up.
Yeah, I agree. I think you need to pull those plants up, put some soil in, put them back in. There you go, Alan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we'll take another call here. And let's see. We've got Richard in Crandon with a call. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Larry. Thank you very much for your show. I enjoy it very much.
Thank you.
I have a I have a question about collecting pumpkin seeds. I plant turnips and radishes. I have about 200 yards, about 2 acres behind my house. I'm in the middle of a 40 that I plant for deer because I like seeing them. And the question I have is, can I collect the seeds from the pumpkins you buy along the highway for Halloween and use them for raising pumpkins? Or are the farmers basically using hybrids?
Well, from what I know is, yeah, you could do that. You know, the thing with the pumpkins and the squash is they can cross-pollinate, so what you get might not be true to type. But if you just are using it for a food source, you know, for the deer, it probably wouldn't matter that it's exactly the same cultivar of pumpkin that might be grown, you know, for a retail-type operation. What do you think about that, Larry?
Yeah, I think you're probably going to be – you're exactly right, Mark. You're not probably not going to get the exact same pumpkin, but – who cares if you're not going to be eating them or doing anything with them yourself?
When I looked at buying them, I bought, it was $3 for a pack for 12 seeds. Duh. That's about three, excuse me, where one pumpkin it will deliver about 50 seeds. That's the reason I'm asking.
Yeah, I would try. I would try it with those and see what happens. I don't think you're going to. You can always, when you get the pumpkins from the farmers, when you purchase them, you can also just ask them what kind of pumpkins they are and if they're hybrids or not. And, then, you know, I just do that, too. But I'd try the ones you've got now. Why not give it a shot?
Right. I will. One more question. What can I do to cause the pumpkin plants to grow better? What kind of fertilizer?
Well, I mean, pretty much, you know, any fertilizer, depending on how big of an area you have. In general, we like to use, like, a more organic, slow release. But there is some pretty interesting information on, you know, like, growing the giant pumpkins that you could look up from those pumpkin growers. But There's some pretty detailed information on how to, like, get really big fruit and pumpkins that you might want to look into, but you might not want to put the effort into it, like, that much, since it is more of just a deer food source. And
but it gives you some guidance.
Right. It gives you some ideas of what time to fertilize to get the largest fruit. Some of the biggest thing, you know, for getting large fruit is having enough water. You know, so depending on the rainfall or if you want to have additional supplemental irrigation, that is a critical thing, too, for larger pumpkins.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Appreciate your call. Well, Audrey called in to suggest, here we are back to Georgia peaches. She says to look for tree-ripe citrus trucks to find Georgia peaches. I never thought we were going to get on Georgia peaches today.
Hey, yeah.
did you, Mark?
No, but hey, the winter solstice, right? It brings out strange things, especially with the full moon-ish tonight.
Do you guys have a an event at the Green Bay Botanical Garden for winter solstice?
No, we don't. I've just really been into it because I heard, you know, that it's almost the full moon, which is tomorrow, actually, but on the solstice, and that's not going to happen again till the year 2094, I believe. So it's kind of a unique time and date.
Oh, we're not likely to be around in 2094.
Yeah, because maybe a peach tree will be, though.
maybe Carl's peach tree will be with us. Well, how many volunteers and how many people do you have working at the gardens?
Wow, I think we have over 500, you know, volunteers, and pretty much we have, I think it's about almost 65 or so volunteers a night for the light show that we put on. So we use a huge amount of people to help us out, you know, doing everything we do. And honestly, without all of the volunteers, Green Bay Botanical Garden wouldn't be what it is. So we really thank them for all of their diligence and hard work throughout the whole year, actually, because without them, we would not be here.
I know I was reading somewhere where just the setup for the light show was over 1,000 hours, volunteer hours, go into that. And that's an amazing number.
Yeah, it really is. And when you think about it, like we said before, it's throughout the whole year, you know, so there's the whole setup part, but then there's also all the preparation and the, creation of the light frames and the fixing of the ones that have kind of gone downhill over the years and kind of thinking where everything is going to go. So it's quite an endeavor.
And what, tell us again now the specific dates and times that people can still see the light display.
Yeah, so it's open tonight, and it goes Friday, December 21st through this Sunday, the 23rd, from 5 to 9 p.m. And then we take a little recess for the Christmas holiday, but then we're back in action on Wednesday, December 26th through Sunday, December 30th from 5 to 9 again. So it's a great time to, you know, come up. You probably have some family, you know, that you have in Wisconsin. It's a great place to go and kind of like share some holiday memories with them.
Well, it's, you've given me some good memories, and our listeners, too, some good things to think about, Mark. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Real pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me, Larry.
Mark Conlock is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. A treat to have him on. And thank you so much for listening. Don't forget, on Monday, Santa will be coming down from the North Pole to talk to the younger members of our audience. So get your kids' lists ready for Monday on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks for listening. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store.